as with all histories, I guess that you could tell the history of tourism from very many like departing points. I do think, from where I'm standing, it is interesting to link it up not just to colonial expansion, to which, of course, it is completely linked, but also, sort of interestingly, to sort of exhibitionary displays. You know, and if you think, for example, of the 1851 like Crystal Palace exhibition and how, you know, Thomas Cook sets the buses of like tourists to go down to the Crystal Palace and see the colonies at home. You know, out of that sort of mode of leisure, which is organized around, in a way, gaping at sort of other cultures, or more specifically, constructed versions of what these other cultures were. You know, Thomas Cook as an industry sort of develops a model. Class is, of course, there from the very beginning because, you know, the Grand Tour, which is also a cultural excursion, right? So when you think of the Grand Tour of the as the sort of precedent of tourism that people, you know, often refer to because it's more kind of kindly than merely talking about colonial expeditions, right? But if you think of the Grand Tour, that was the pre-museum, right? So you don't bring the artifacts home, you go there where they are. And at that point, it is European-centric. So you go to Italy, you go to Paris, you sort of follow very carefully curated guides that tell you where you will go and see the attractions. And that then gets expanded to like a wider sort of like class composition. But it happens simultaneously through the museum and through tourism. So, you know, what you have with the opening of the Louvre, around 1800 date, which is quite sort of an iconic date of modernity, is that looting of those artifacts that had already been signposted by the tour guides. So the commissioners at the Louvre literally use the kind of guides that had been composed for the Grand Tour to sort of identify where they should send the troops to loot. So it's a kind of looting with good taste, which is also very important because this is a revolutionary government that needs to say, yes, but we are also civilized. So civilization is demonstrated paradoxically through the sort of looting of artifacts that are already kind of, you know, wrapped up in this history of good taste, which means that as a kind of French peasant, suddenly you have access to these artifacts that other people could only have access to through tourism. But as we know as well, what happens immediately after is that this looting expands. This is also very interesting because immediately after the sort of the defeat of Napoleon, Europe agrees not to loot itself. You know, so there's all these like treaties that are signed saying, you know, this is a barbarian thing to do. We won't be looting like Napoleon did, et cetera, et cetera. But they sort of not explicitly but implicitly exclude the colonies. So then, you know, you have this moment of like the expansion of like looting towards, you know, I mean, we know, but, you know, very famously, the Benin Bronzes, for example. I mean, Britain being one of the most like fervent defenders of the barbarism of looting, you know, like Britain pays to take the artifacts that Napoleon loots back to the Vatican as a kind of symbol of its own kind of civilizatory power. And then immediately after goes to Benin and loots the city in the most kind of violent and kind of horrendous and bloody way. I do think that it's impossible to sort of de-link tourism from that kind of experience of the colonial. Mary Louise Pratt, who writes this wonderful book called Imperial Eyes, already kind of signposts this very clearly. You know, there is a kind of imperial gaze that commands what lies in front of it and kind of composes a version of the world based on what surrenders itself to the gaze. That's completely constructed, but incredibly sort of effective, you know, effective in terms of how it orders the world. So to me, that's also interesting because, of course, that's, again, what the museum does, you know, to sort of construct this version of the totality under one roof. Which appears to some degree sort of natural or necessary, but it is always, you know, serving a particular gaze.
Under the promise of prosperity for impoverished and underdeveloped parts of the planet, tourism has emerged as a dominant force, shaping the intricate landscapes of neoliberal capitalism. Orchestrating a complex interplay of exploitation and interdependence, The tourism industry leverages resources and labour to feed an ever-expanding, ever-expansive Ouroboric structure. For decades, scholars around the world have been warning about the detrimental effects of the travel industry on the environment and local communities. We sat down with the transdisciplinary researcher and curator, Yaisa Hernandez, to get to the heart of her deep dive research into what she has coined terminal tourism. Drawing upon that long tradition of academic scholarship, but also from a situated perspective as a Canary Islands native, Yaisa unpacks the constellation of problems orbiting the travel industry, from environmental degradation to rampant gentrification and the subsequent disruption of local infrastructures, and a whole host of socioeconomic inequalities. We talk to Yaisa Hernandez about kind islands, digital nomads, imperial boomerangs, platform capitalism, grand tours, museums as tourist commodities, monoculture mentality, looting with good taste, and what Veronica Gago has called neoliberalism from below.
The first thing to say is that a concept is quite a serious thing. You know, we tend to, especially in the art world, engage in endless terminological innovation. Let's find a new word. So I'm not sure I have a concept yet. It's more like a constellation of problems that accrue around this issue of terminal tourism. But I guess that, you know, what you have at some time with mass tourism, and in a sense, the moment of like peak mass tourism is the moment of peak modernity, you know, that moment when modernity seemed to be, you know, potentially able to deliver on its promises. And those promises often fell under the rubric of development, right? So, you know, you have a kind of mid-20th century moment when, you know, the colonies are gaining liberation, they are being promised development, and tourism is such a kind of cheap and cheerful way of achieving development, because it's like you don't need infrastructure, you don't need that much investment, you don't really need a lot of time, you just got all these natural resources, which, you know, historically is what the colonizers told them was the peak of their ability. All you can provide is natural resources, right? So you sell those chips to us, we'll kind of do something with it, sell that back to you. So with tourism, there's almost like a kind of uncomfortable parallel, right, with a sort of economy of dependency. It's like, hey, you have natural resources, you know, you've got the beach, you've got the sand, you've got the lovely vegetation. So just on the basis of that, you can develop this industry. And that will eventually yield, you know, a much better lifestyle, you know, welfare, et cetera, development. And of course, what happens is that when you're talking about incredibly depressed economies, you know, economies that are not economies of survival, but often of non-survival, something like tourism delivers to some extent, you know. So there's some years where it is kind of undeniable to say that the kind of lifestyle of places that put all their eggs on the basket of tourism gets better, but gets better and quickly stalls. And then, of course, what happens very quickly is that the industry becomes ever more extractive, so that it's not, you know, even the local elites that have a little hotel or, you know, turn their kind of land into like a camping site. But increasingly, and more so after the last two financial crises, it's like large corporate groups, large hedge funds, you know, buying up, you know, territory and land, and actually scooping all kind of profit away from the territories that host the tourists. We have seen those kinds of moves in places like Barcelona with platform economies like Airbnb, you know, how that happens. So graphically, you know, you put a flat on Airbnb, nobody here can afford to live in Barcelona anymore. And the money is going off to Airbnb miles away from Barcelona, but it's far from a new model, right? It's like tour operators have been doing that for decades, you know, well before platform capitalism, and the effects on the local populations haven't been that different. It's just that now, you know, in that kind of imperial boomerang way, and what was happening in other latitudes is coming up to places like Barcelona, but that's not That's not new. So to go back to this issue of flight terminal tourism, you know, I suppose the first sense in which it is terminal is that the promise of development is no longer one that anybody can buy. You know, it's almost like all these people that were kind of waiting for tourism to lift them up already know that's not going to happen, because in a way we are actually now worse than we were. I mean, COVID-19 was like a really like strong moment at that level, because suddenly you realize the fragility of the whole industry and your enormous dependency on it. You know, territories that survive on tourism, as a rule, treat it almost like a monoculture. So if tourism goes, everything goes. There's no economy. And after 30 years, 40 years, 50 years of devoting your whole territory, life, affection, hopes and expectations on tourism, tourism can like disappear like that and you're gone. But then, of course, this, you know, COVID-19 is not something that you can think as exceptional, because before COVID-19, you had climate change and that was already, you know, creeping at the door. So who's going to go to your resort if it's 45 degrees and there's a forest fire every summer? You know, that possibility of climate change making it untenable for these places to survive on tourism was already there before COVID-19. So now there's a kind of sense on the part of many economies that have placed their hopes and expectations on tourism that it's clearly not going to deliver. It's going to go away before it delivers anything. The problem is that this is very unevenly felt. So the people, workers, you know, cleaners, waiters, you know, the whole kind of, you know, precarious workforce that gathers around tourism are keenly aware of its inability to deliver. But as a rule, something that tourism brings with it as well is the kind of corruption, you know, whether legal or illegal corruption, that surrounds a monoculture. So in places that are primarily organized around tourism, you know, governments at whatever sphere they operate are controlled by tourism. So one aspect of this terminality is this kind of coexistence of a kind of, I don't know how to put it, a certainty that development is not going to arrive, but an inability as well to sort of think of alternative life plans, alternative economies. You know, it's almost like we're just going to squeeze this lemon for everything it has to give, but there's nothing, you know, beyond that. To give an example, for example, the whole idea of digital nomads. Okay, so it's almost like we cannot continue to travel. You know, climate change makes this whole idea of like a yearly holiday in the sun profoundly unsustainable, but also the places, you know, the places that tend to welcome the most tourists are becoming the most uninhabitable as well. So it's clear that at least the current geography of tourism cannot survive. But then how do we flip that and still promote an economy of tourism? Let's just attract digital nomads. And that, for me, also has a kind of particularly sort of like cutting, I don't know how to put it, but like kind of emotional sort of message. Because, you know, when you're calling for digital nomads to come and develop you, is like, you know, the poster image of the digital nomad is somebody in their 20s or 30s with a computer who does, you know, programming or whatever, which is precisely the kind of thing that you could train your youth to do. I mean, you see this in the Canary Islands very clearly. I mean, there's like, and the Canary Islands are in Spain, you know, they are the poorest region in Spain, but they are part of like a major economy. You know, they're absolutely a privileged actor in the soft geography of tourism. And yet, you know, we have a government that has spent millions trying to promote the idea of digital nomads, you know, with islands like Fuerteventura, who was the first one to call for a water emergency, you know, increasingly becoming, you know, a kind of expat kingdom for digital nomads. You know, this like very cool place that you can retire to when the world is on fire. But there's like two universities there. And it never occurred to them that perhaps you just train people to do something other than serve the digital nomads. You know, it's still, you know, so it sounds minor, but I think it is, you know, the premise of that is like, you will never become one of them. You will just like make their beds. It sends, I don't know how to put it, but it's like with those kind of messages, this developmental fantasy that people were happy to so swallow for so long becomes harder and harder to swallow. It's also terminal, I think, because there's something that has shifted in the way that tourism sells itself, so that it was always about, you know, 2 weeks of rest and relaxation while you sort of then go back to your work, wherever it is. And now it is really about rest, you know, a kind of refuge. So there's a kind of new rhetoric around tourism, which is about how unlivable life is becoming, like everywhere else. I mean, in COVID, we saw that, like people leaving the city and going to the countryside, like the countryside was somehow, you know, immune from everything else. But this is happening more and more in relation to climate change, in relation to the fact that cities like Barcelona are becoming completely inhabitable because you would need to work so much to like pay for like housing in the center, you know, that you kind of end up living in L'Hospitalet or wherever, and then you're like traveling for hours to get to work, you know. But hey, wouldn't it be lovely if I just lived in the countryside and I had a computer and, you know, I woke up in the morning and look at the birds and nature and then kind of did a bit of work. So there's that kind of new, you know, which is, of course, you know, the digital nomad is there, but there's kind of more perverse things like, you know, this fantasy of saving yourself from climate change by, say, buying large weights of land in New Zealand or the Azores or outside of San Francisco. So it's almost like there's been a kind of indistinction of like tourism and life, but tourism now is also offering this fantasy that after everything ends or after life becomes unlivable in other places, there's this other life in the land of tourism where everything is good, except that it is, you know, a complete sort of desperate optimism. Like, you'll also die if we all die, even if you are in your bunker in New Zealand, right? I mean, it's not. So it's those kind of constellations of things, you know, in a sense, a kind of exhaustion of the promise of development, but equally this other sense in which is the thing that comes after the end. You know, so we know that modernity has failed us. We know that, you know, climate change is seemingly unstoppable. We know that, you know, what seems to be coming our way is something pretty apocalyptic. But instead of rallying around and saying, well, let's stop that apocalypse from happening, it's like, oh, let's find this other refuge place where we're going to be okay and nature is going to be around us and blah, blah, blah. I mean, we can talk also about the kind of horrible ideas, you know, tied to that in terms of the Tescreal, so-called Tescreal sort of group of ideologies, you know, around Silicon Valley and these notions of, you know, transhumanism and effective altruism and, you know, this idea that perhaps it's good if everybody dies and we are the only ones that remain in New Zealand in our little tourist paradise because that'll be good for the planet, right? I mean, that we can sort of elaborate ideas such as those ones to hold on to a version of the good life that we refuse to give up is quite alarming to me because these people are not, you know, they hold enough power to sort of act on those ideas to some extent, right? So that the urgency of finding solutions is no longer urgent. Like, millions of us can die. That'll be good for the planet. You know, that's sustainable as far as they're concerned. But I'll be okay in my New Zealand forest. I think this is absolutely the reason why I think it's important to go back to thinking of tourism as a cultural product as well, as a kind of form of industry and economy, because I do think that when at least I became aware of the first, if you want, critical studies of tourism, they were sort of tied up in a tradition of what we might call postmodern thinking. So it was all about the experience of the tourist. You know, these were the times of Dean McCannell, so late 70s, thinking about authenticity as the thing that tourists were like looking for, but this kind of ironic way in which authenticity always kind of flipped into its opposite and everything was staged. Jung Uri in the Tourist Gaze, or, you know, Barbara Kirschenblatt, Gimblett. You know, there's a kind of really interesting moment of thinking of tourism as a kind of, as a mode in which culture appears and culture as a staging. And there's a lot of really good work there. And I sort of engaged with it quite fruitfully, 25 years ago when I actually published my first ever text in a book. I was drawing substantially from them. But I guess because I come from the Canary Islands, so I never really occupy primarily the role of the tourist, but the role of the person who had to sort of countenance the tourist. And there's really powerful ways in which that shapes you. I mean, the generation that comes after you in Barcelona might have to live with that. But, you know, simple things like, you know, you went to a cafe and the napkin said Tenerife la Isla Amable, so like Tenerife, the kind island. And, you know, there were like campaigns to like make you smile, you know, be like the kind island was not telling us everybody's going to be kind to you, but be kind to them. You know, you ought to be kind because that's what our industry depends on. That's a very odd way of like growing up, but also your sense of exposure. So like I spend all my summers in La Gomera. That was a very kind of, you know, alternative destination for like, you know, what we at the time called hippies. But they were very overt, you know, in a very different way from, say, the British tourists of the kind of sea and sand kind of variety that we had in Tenerife. They were very overt in their kind of anthropological longings. So they would like stare at you, you know, as like kids playing in the street with whatever made up toys you had. You know, suddenly you had a group of Germans staring at what you were doing. Like that was somehow, you know, worthy of attention, a kind of attention that our own grown-ups didn't give us, you know. So it's a very special position, you know. It's not, and that was completely untheorized in that literature because the whole kind of attention was on the tourists themselves, you know, what tourists wanted, what they were looking for. And, you know, very often in that sort of slightly like humorous, slightly snobbish way in which, you know, sort of jump between the authentic and the fake, the kind of mass produced and the kind of, minority or sort of more refined sort of way of traveling, et cetera, et cetera. And while it was interesting, it seemed very partial. So for me, I think the moment of going back to tourism and thinking, aha, this is not just interesting to me, but actually really touches something very effective, if you want, you know, like this is something that I feel compelled to continue to pursue, was encountering Jamaica Kincaid, whom I never read before. But small place, which some of you might know, but it's a very, very small book, which she just writes as a kind of hate letter to tourists. And it's a very angry book. But just following the kind of trace of Jamaica Kincaid, and then, you know, this whole group of women that Bernadette Vicuña González has referred to them as the angry women of tourism. So how this like experience of like women that grew in places like Hawaii or Cyprus or Granada, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like how growing up under tourism, growing up a woman as well, which is not the same as growing up a mom in a tourist destination, because as soon as you are a woman in a tourist destination, you're also a kind of object of what, you know, you're also there as an attraction to tourists and potentially, obviously, as part of a kind of sexual economy in which you are one of the many natural wonders that place has to offer. That, of course, for me was like, ha, well, this is, you know, this is the reverse case and this is so important to sort of put out there. So then, of course, when you read, you know, what some people call critical tourism studies, their attention has been put rightly on those kinds of, you know, economic mechanisms of extractions, on the kind of continuation of colonialism by other means, on the kind of forceful ways, if you want, in which populations remain proletarianized. You know, for example, the withdrawal of formal education in many places, you know, and often under the kind of premise that because employment is plentiful and immediately available, there's no need for higher education. You know, you're just going to become a waiter anyway. So just become a waiter at 16. So there's really, really interesting work at that level, which for me has been very important to engage with. But I guess the issue about effectiveness, or the issue as well of, you know, where do I come into this? Because much as I am interested in this, I'm not a tourism scholar, right? It's actually the cultural construction that these earlier scholars were talking about, while it might not be the whole story, is absolutely crucial to the way in which tourism reproduces itself, and actually to the way in which tourism reproduces itself both for like hosts and guests. And that's the kind of weirdest thing to sort of acknowledge, that it's not just that tourists are hooked on their 2 weeks of holidays. It's also that local populations that have been, you know, mistreated by the tourist industry for decades, that have nothing really to show for that industry, often remain completely committed to it as well. You know, in a sense, there's no horizon beyond that. And the idea that you could get rid of tourism is simply terrifying. So sort of trying to sort of understand that, you know, what are the kind of affective attachments that tourism is so adept at constructing, you know, why is it that we find it so hard to move beyond it? Matilde Cordova Azcárate, who is a Spanish anthropologist based in the US now, but has done a really beautiful work called Stuck with Tourism, I think has done something really nice, which is to bring these two traditions together. And although she doesn't kind of necessarily develop it, she talks about this notion of stuckness. You know, it's like how you get stuck with it. And once it kind of gathers you, you don't see that you can, you know, she calls it sticky, which I think is also great, you know. So it's like, and I think that that's the quality that I am intrigued by, and it's thereby our responsibility, if you want, as people who produce affects, you know, as cultural producers and cultural critics, we are constantly producing affects. And I think it's kind of a responsibility to intervene there and to sort of try to disrupt that to some extent, with a certain amount of urgency as well. Because if it was down to sort of rationality, like, we all know this isn't sustainable anymore. The industry knows it isn't sustainable. So how can you open up that conversation, talk about what other forms of, not just travel, because I don't really think tourism is about travel, but what other forms of imagining alternative lives are open to us, perhaps closer to home, perhaps not as individual or family pursuits, but as more collective exercises in imagination. You know, where could that happen? What would be the time and the space for that? What form could that take that could be equally joyful? I mean, Jonathan Cooler said that tourism always ended in disappointment. And I think there is, you know, a truth to that. You know, tourism feeds on lots of anticipation, but often just a sense of disappointment that, in a way, these 2 weeks don't compensate for the rest of your horrible life. So I strongly, I mean, this might sound completely naive, but I do strongly suspect that if we were to cultivate a kind of tourism otherwise, a tourism that actually was much more, you know, embroiled in everyday life, that didn't, you know, exist as the compensatory sort of mechanism for your 50 weeks of misery, but as something that interweave with your 52 weeks of life and provided exercises of, if you want, radical imagination, which is what this speculation about what your holidays are going to be like often are. You know, we might end up with something that is less disappointing and more joyful, but it's just not going to come out of thin air, right? So that's also, I think, a job for us as cultural producers to think, because the other thing that I guess I am very clear about is that there isn't a million miles of distance between what art offers and what tourism offers. You know, they're both kind of posited there. I mean, apart from the fact that they are contemporaneous, they emerge at the same time, you know, their function is fairly similar. You know, they sort of imagine a world otherwise. So this is not about the extant. It's about what it could be. And it's this kind of moment of, like, we can imagine or speculate on something that's not what we already know, but something not yet, or something that we don't quite know yet, even if it's out there. That's, of course, you know, a moment of, you know, utopian thought, a moment of creativity, the moment where the kind of unexpected happens. But it's also a moment of political liberation. You know, it's what every kind of political imagination needs. So, yeah, I think that's the kind of affection that I'm thinking about. And I guess the other thing to say, I mean, some other resource that I found quite useful to think about that is how could that provide a sort of moment of recognition between hosts and guests, right? I mean, when you sort of live somewhere like Tenerife, which is a very proletarian destination, right? It's not a five-star destination. Like I live in the UK now, spend about 3-4 months a year in Tenerife. And the UK people that travel to Tenerife largely, you know, they work as waiters and cleaners, and you know, so it's the kind of place where you can buy 2 weeks in the sun for like 300 quid. So if you save very methodically all year, you might be able to do that every 2 years or so. So the hosts and the guests in places like that are kind of part of the same class. They're kind of basically just trading places, but there's no moment of coming together at all, right? In a sense, when you are the guest, you are playing colonizer for 2 weeks, and you're really like enjoying that role. Somebody made a bed for me, somebody, you know, and you're probably exhausted and you need it. But the payback for those 2 weeks is that you go back to making beds for the rest of the year. So I also think, you know, the thinking of ways of integrating what tourism and potentially what art gives us into everyday life that allows us to recognize our kind of shared quality as hosts, you know, even when we are on holidays, is quite important. And there's this concept, and this is a concept, not a terminological innovation, that Veronica Gago put forward, of neoliberalism from below. And I think that's like a really useful tool through which to think the kind of precarious economies of tourism. Because I think, you know, I've talked about how tourists get hooked on the idea of tourism, but hosts also get hooked on the idea of tourism, you know. So you're probably seeing this in Barcelona. I certainly see it in Tenerife. You know, you have a moment when increasingly, as I said, it's not even like local business people buying hotels, but like massive hedge funds buying whole seafronts. But then Airbnb comes up. And then like your grandma dies and you have a flat in the middle of a housing state, but you can put it on Airbnb and you can become, you know, a businessman yourself. And people have opted like massively for that, as I suspect has been the case in Barcelona, despite, you know, tighter regulations. So that in places like Santa Cruz, for example, that historically never had, you know, a strong presence of tourists other than, say, day trippers, now it's almost impossible, you know, to rent a long-term flat because everything is just kind of... And this doesn't really sort your life out, economically speaking. You know, there's so much competition, there's so much, you know, competing Airbnbs that people don't necessarily see their kind of material conditions improve in any significant way. And certainly they're not necessarily better than they would be if they would just put that flat and rent it to like a peer who live there on a permanent basis. But there is some fantasy of the kind of tourist entrepreneur. There is this kind of attachment as well to this notion that we, you know, because we can't see anything else, you know, there might be a way in which this pays off, in which eventually, you know, I do become like, you know, Meliá or Barceló or all of these people. And that's also, you know, that's also an entanglement. I mean, I can't list them off the top of my head, but they are all pretty much on the same. I mean, Tenerife, it's a song. It's very bizarre, actually, and he might not appreciate me saying this. My dad, who has, you know, quite severe cognitive decline, one of the very few sentences that that he repeats all the time is Tenerife tiene seguro de sol. It's like this thing that's like in his head, you know, when he's forgotten, you know, so many. So I don't remember many slogans, but I think that they are all in the same kind of cadence. So it's all about being kind, being good, you know, the smiling place, the you know, where you make friends as soon as you land, you know, everything is about how the people are going to be there. You're going to, you know, have their sociability straight away. Of course, behind those kind of slogans that appeal to friendship, love, kindness, you know, welcoming, there is always sexual economy as well, which I always find slightly perverse, you know, because this is about mostly, you know, making yourself sexually available to those people who might arrive, you know, because you might travel with friends, or you might travel on your own, or you might travel in, you know, seeking company for the night. So we're going to call it friendship, but it's primarily as well about the availability of bodies, you know, not just about a kind of kindred disposition. And then there's the Seguro de Sol, which is kind of quite, I mean, this, like, we felt bad when it rained. You know, it was like, you know, in a place that is now, you know, like so many other places, you know, under, you know, danger of, you know, both overheating, you know, constant forest fires, this like Category 6 fires, which we never even knew were a thing before. You know, what kind of food sovereignty has become an issue, despite the fact that, you know, we should be plentiful, etc., etc. That it would rain was such a disappointment. You know, it's like, you know, like you take those things personally. It's almost like we are letting them down. You know, it's like we told them that they would be here and it would be sunny. So how terrible of us to sort of rain on them. But I'm going off on something else entirely, but thinking about this, you know, Seguro de Sol, the tourist industry now knows that it's going to desert all these places, which I think is, you know, like from the logic of the insurance, you know, something that you would do is risk analysis. And of course, places like the Canary Islands, places like Greece, places like the whole of the north of Africa, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, places that have historically also devoted themselves to tourism quite massively, they already know they're not viable. So they are redrawing the maps of the tourist industry and shifting everything north. It will get too hot. It will be, you know, too subject to sort of environmental volatility, fires, hurricanes. You know, like you can't run an industry like that. So at the moment, you have places like, you know, Cancun or whatever that continue to operate despite, you know, being battered by hurricanes on a regular basis, primarily because this is just like hedge fund land now. And it's like, if it lasts 5-6 years, we'll get our money back. If not, you know, we got our money spread in different bets and, you know, we can withstand that kind of impact. But closer to home, I mean, this whole kind of southern Mediterranean sort of region and certainly, you know, the area going down West Africa where the Canary Islands are, I mean, all of that is going to disappear from the tourism map. And they're already kind of thinking of places like, you know, northern Spain, south of France, but also going up to the resorts that were abandoned in the 50s and 60s in Britain, like Hastings or Scarborough or whatever, as being the places that people would want to visit in the summer, because they will still be kind of, you know, moderate, you know, like the weather will be livable and kind of mild enough to have an enjoyable time. And there's zero thinking of how they would, you know, devolve some of what they have extracted on these regions. It's just like, off. You know, I don't know, like you have a plan. So it's kind of very, you know, terminal again in that, you know, if you talk to the sort of Canary Islands government, their plan for the next 50 years is tourism. But when you go to like, you know, trade conferences by the tourist industry, I mean, this is like stuff is being published in the Financial Times quite openly. You know, it's not like it's a secret. It's not a trade secret. They're already relocating their industry. But in places like the Canary Islands, they're acting like that's not happening. So that kind of terminal delusion is also very present there, you know, because they will just leave. eventually. And you will be left there, and there's nothing. They're never going to share any profits with you. I mean, if they're living in an orderly manner, is precisely not to share any profits with you, right? I don't really think that there is such a thing as sustainable tourism, right? I mean, because that's what the kind of industry has been talking about for a long time. And it's like, even in kind of critical tourism studies, this is a kind of problem, because when you, like, if you do operate as a tourism scholar, chances are you're kind of housed in a tourism studies department. And tourism studies is, by and large, dominated by how to do tourism well kind of studies. You know, so there's a kind of pretty acritical acceptance that tourism is there, almost like an acceptance of this like ludicrous notion, the Organización Mundial para el Turismo, which is the, so the United Nations doesn't really have organizations like these that are devoted to a particular industry other than tourism, because I say the only kind of offshoot of the United Nations that is about an industry is this one about tourism. But that also tells you about how it was tied to these kind of notions of development, and particularly how it was tied to notions of development in formerly colonized nations. But something that I think I mentioned to Anna before, but it's kind of puzzling, is that they declare tourism a human right. So like you need to, you know, being able to sort of exercise your right to tourism is fundamentally like a human right, which is bizarre. And of course, only they recognize it as a human right. But tourism studies tends to kind of naturalize that state of things, you know, that tourism will continue to be, that everybody has a right to be a tourist, and then just try to sort of ameliorate the current crisis. So how can we do it a little bit better? And then you get tangled up in all sorts of things because, of course, as I said, you know, very often the host populations are very attached to these notions of tourism as well. You know, it's not just the tourists, but also the host populations. So then you work with, you know, like a community somewhere to say, okay, so let's try to do it so that other than just coming to the hotel and spending all the money on the resorts, the tourists are also going to come to your cooperative when you produce textiles, and they're going to buy your textiles so that you get a little bit more of the sharing profits. And that's the direction in which a lot of this ameliorating kind of rhetoric goes. You know, let's do it a little bit less worse. Let's try to, you know, get a bit more of a sharing profits, but often, you know, almost like a kind of charitable, you know, NGO-like addition to what is, you know, a very kind of predatory and extractive and ultimately unsustainable sort of industry. It's probably me being narrow-minded, but like when you read all of this, and when you read all of this, you know, not just in the wake of, you know, a climate crisis, but in the wake of, you know, what Adam Tooze might call a polycrisis, you know, is economical crisis, is health crisis, is climate crisis, and it's all the crisis at the same time. It just feels so small, so tokenistic, and, you know, like the idea of, and also just so wrong to call it sustainable, you know, call it less bad, call it, you know, a bit less shitty, but let's not call it sustainable. But then, of course, you know, when you talk about abolishing tourism, it's us kind of ruthless and cruel and tyrannical, really, as this notion of the industry migrating north and, say, into places like the north of Africa or the Canary Islands. F you, I'm off to Scarborough, right? So I guess the other conversation that is kind of urgent is how you A, sort of transition out of tourism, but B, how you share the profits of tourism in a way that allow for that transition. And that, to me, is a kind of job that governments should be doing. You know, that's what I would expect a government in the Canary Islands to be campaigning for at a time like this. You know, it's like, well, if you're going to stay here even for a few more years, you know, this is about, you know, getting as much from this industry as we possibly can in order to sort of fund a different kind of model of a sustainable economy that no longer depends on tourism. So it's, you know, like so many things in this kind of end times structure of feelings that we inhabit. It's like we are late to that. You know, this should already be happening. And it's really, there's no talk of redistribution. There's no talk of these people, you know, compensating us for the you know, not just extraction, but, you know, terraforming of a landscape. I mean, I think I share, because this is what happens when you read all these angry women, I share with many people around the world, you know, this notion of planetary grief, you know, this idea that we are all kind of weeping for the planet. I remember crying, like arriving in La Gomera one summer and crying at seeing what had happened to that place. But no, this is not me. This is anybody who has grown up in a place where tourism has terraformed and kind of devastated the landscape to such a degree, you know, that it's almost like somebody came and bombed, and after the bomb, they build the hotels. But, you know, places that you have an intimate, affective connection to suddenly disappear. You know, the beach is gone and there's a yachting port, or, you know, that ravine where you used to play no longer exists because there's like a... And it's quite, you know, because we do have, you know, emotional attachments to places. And these places get transformed when tourism arrives at a massive rate. They get destroyed, you know, vegetation is decimated, you know, all of these things happen, you know. So planetary grief is something that people in these places knew before climate change was something that we talked about. But they won't pay for it either, you know. I mean, so it's not even just about, you know, share your profits, but compensate, you know, restitution, which is the word, you know. I mean, they won't. They'll get out scot-free, and it's... You know, that's another sense in which it is, you know, terminal. You know, I mean, unless we start talking about this, unless we start, you know, as a political body demanding this, you know, governments won't campaign for this, partly because they are, you know, as I said, corrupt, whether legally or illegally corrupt, but very much in the pockets of these monocultures. So it'll be gone and it'll be nothing left. And that's sort of devastating. That tourism never pays what it takes out, I think, is pretty clear. I mean, in fact, in Spain, of course, you have this like little tax, the tourism tax. So like you have to pay 15 euros when you come here as a tourist to sort of account for, you know, all the infrastructure and all the kind of additional costs that an island needs to. I'm saying an island, it's not always an island, but that the city needs to sort of provide to sort of account for your presence here. You know, we are talking about millions of extra people. And if these were migrants, right, if say, you know, Tenerife or Mallorca had to welcome 3 million migrants a year, you know, there would be endless talk about the cost, the unsustainable cost of providing healthcare, infrastructure, you know, waste, water, you know, schooling is impossible, right? So if they were migrants, we would just say, no, 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 you know, cannot do. But when they're tourists, we just do. And then we charge them 15 euros a year, which is clearly, you know, insufficient even at the level of infrastructure, right? So this is how something that should be a debt that the tourist industry has with us becomes a kind of socialized cost for us. You know, we just, you know, we have to provide the water, we have to provide the waste disposal, we have to provide, you know, the golf courses, you know, in the Canary Islands for these people. So these tokenistic taxes are the kind of minor recognition of those costs. But I think it's pretty obvious to anyone really who spends 2 minutes thinking about what the real costs are, the 15 euros don't really count it. I was going to say that in Spain as well, I think some of the best, you know, critical thinking around the economies of tourism and the ways in which this kind of influx of the industry has affected particular regions, you know, some of the best thinking, and that has come from Spain. So the network Alba Sud, which comes out of the Balearic Islands, absolutely merits, you know, a lot of time and attention, because they have published on this a lot. People like Ivan Murray or Ernest Cañadas, but not just them. I mean, I think they have a really good website with lots of resources, and it's worth engaging with their work because it explains the kind of costs of tourism quite clearly. And this is necessary because governments tend to tell us that this is the richness, you know, that this is where, you know, economy, what economy depends on. There's an economy of misery wages. It's an economy where, you know, yeah, Barceló, Amelia, and all these people get richer and richer and richer, and then they can open, you know, hotels in Punta Cana as well as Mallorca. But it, for us, it has a cost, and it affects our infrastructure, it affects our well-being, and it affects our future. And I think this notion of the future as well is quite... it's quite important, you know, like how do you charge somebody for the fact that they're extracting your future? You know, it's like you're leaving me without a future. Never mind that you're kind of taking away my water, or that, you know, I'm having to pay extra taxes for you to sort of like manage your waste. You are taking away my future. So how much is that? 15 euros a month or 15 euros per visitor seems a bit puny to me. So, yeah. Of course, the whole kind of lie of the authentic experience is that it was always inauthentic because you could get out, right? It's like, if I'm all, you know, I can have the authentic experience, you're stuck here, I'm going. But I think that's that issue of mobility, I think is like really, really crucial to this thinking as well. Because, you know, I remember like Etienne Balibar talking about the kind of forcefully immobile about 20 years ago, you know, the fact that we are thinking of kind of globalized, of a globalized world. But there's also, you know, those people who cannot move. And often it's not just because your passport doesn't allow you to move, but, you know, because you don't have the economic conditions to sort of like move anywhere. So that all this, you know, anti-globalization movement that appears initially as like progressive, you know, anti-capitalism by your other name, ends up, you know, in something like Trump and like America First kind of, you know, localism. So that you need to sort of think of these figures, of those who cannot move, as political actors as well, who are kind of traversed by that immobility. You know, like, if my place goes to shit, I go to shit. But tourism introduces like another counterfigure, which is quite interesting to that, which is those who are forcefully displaced. You know, so that, you know, for example, in Mexico now there's like campaigns, well, in many places, but el derecho a no migrar. You know, so like in Latin America in general, but where I'm more familiar with the campaign is these campaigns of, you know, I should have a right to stay here. You know, I don't particularly want to go to the US or, you know, potentially die trying. But then tourism is a kind of, you know, quite a difficult actor in that, because on the one hand, it can potentially, you know, provide the means not to migrate. On the other hand, often directly displaces people. You know, I mean, it is important because I mean, in a sense, I wasn't mentioning the Tren Maya, but the Tren Maya, I mean, the derecho no migrar has become a refrain, not just in Mexico, but obviously the Tren Maya is the main moment of appearance. And the problem is that we go back to that attachment, you know, and Tren Maya can promise that things will change, that we'll get better, et cetera, et cetera. But you're also being displaced. You're also being, you know, so it's, yeah. But that issue, you know, that issue of the relationship with the territory, I think it's at the heart of this problem. So that it's sort of important to think of tourism both in relation to mobility, but then, yes, also in relation to migration, you know, because you stay put, You know, that's the thing. I mean, it's like, as a host, you stay put. But it's kind of scant consolation, right? So it's, that's kind of what I mean. It's like all of this is, of course, it's economic. Of course, it's infrastructural. But it is absolutely emotional. It's about, you know, self-identity. It's about, you can't intervene there if you don't intervene in that kind of texture of affects that are making you wish that with development comes your ability to stay put, or making you wish that with development comes your ability to thrive, as well as, you know, making you hope that 2 weeks in the sun is going to sort out your marriage. You know, it's all profoundly affective. Place where you see that very, very clearly, for example, is in the smaller islands, you know, both in the Canaries or in the Balearics, but also, you know, islands everywhere, because that travel is very, you know, you need to cross the water. So if you grow, say, you grow somewhere like La Gomera, El Hierro, La Palma, you know, any of the smaller islands that that populate in the Canary Islands, you know, your universities are in the main ones. In the smaller ones, you have a job. Straight away, pretty much. You know, you can get a job, which is quite good fun when you're 18, to work in something that is orientated around leisure. You can be a waiter, you can be a chambermaid, you can be, you know, you'll have an income straight away if you don't go to college. You can also participate in the sort of whole economy of the nightlife. And when I say economy, you know, for example, you know, without having any kind of authority to say this other than, you know, lived experience, young men, when I was growing up, would often sleep with countless tourists for no money, okay? They didn't get any money. They just got a lot of sex. So that seemed great. And that's a kind of potentially more pleasurable way to spend your 20s than to go to college and become an engineer. But then, you know, there is a kind of, again, you know, this notion of the future, you know, there is a future then that then is mapped out for you, because at some point you won't be the most desirable thing to sleep with. And then, you know, you are breaking your back with potentially quite physical labor or, you know, very unforgiving hours for the rest of your life. And, you know, housing has become ever more inaccessible. So you know, but by the time you're like 40 and you realize maybe this wasn't the deal, it's kind of too late. So it is something that you see replicated in throughout the kind of tourist economy. But I don't think it's accidental. I mean, I think that, you know, why would you move to a tourist resort where you can't necessarily live there because it's too expensive? You know, it's like you have moments when people migrate there at times of booms or whatever, but it's not necessarily attractive enough. You know, the kind of wages that you get, et cetera, and the sort of level of exploitation that you're subjected to, it's not attractive enough to sort of depend exclusively on migrant labor. So you create a kind of local population that's, in a sense, unable to access anything else. You know, there's no effort to sort of educate the population. It's never unintentional. And that's kind of what I meant earlier when I was talking about digital nomads, that it's almost like throwing salt on the wound, you know, to sort of say, not only are we not providing sort of educational opportunities for you, but we think that you're kind of incapable of becoming this like 25-year-old programmer. So we're just going to import, you know, like young people with like skills to sort of raise the economy. It's quite a cruel thing to do to your own youth, right? And it's, you know, it's how tourism depicts them, right? I mean, it's like we know that, you know, for a long time that we, you know, there's that famous text by Johannes Fabian, Time and the Other. I don't know if you, but, you know, like this notion of non-coevalence, you know, so that us in Barcelona continue to evolve, but like if you go to Hawaii, they're still kind of dancing and stuck in the past. You know, so that notion of people being stuck in the past, it's you know, fundamental to, you know, how anthropology makes its object, but how we ourselves end up thinking of these destinations, people who are stuck in the past. And we are actually quite disappointed as well, right? So if you go somewhere and it looks very 2024, it's like, oh, I was expecting something a little bit more 1950s, you know? So it plays quite powerfully in our expectations of the host nations. But even it gets internalized, you know? It's like something, for example, that I need to speak about with my students every single year when they arrive, is that you have students, you know, some place like Goldsmiths, you get all these, you know, rich students from all over the world. And often when you're asking them, and why did you choose to come here? And it's like, oh, it's because in London, everything is like 30 years ahead of wherever it is. And it's like 30 years ahead in direction of where, you know, it's like, what's this kind of weird? So it's very, very powerful. You know, this notion of non-coevalence is visible in tourism in very important ways. You know, for example, when you think of the ways in which hosts are often made to dress up, they always dress up as people from the past, right? You know, that's another kind of trope. But it goes, you know, it seeps like further than that. So, I mean, that's also interesting in terms of how my own thinking of tourism, because I've been really, in a sense, talking about tourism generally, but what I'm trying to work on is how, when you think of what we might call this sort of global phase of the art world, you discover a lot of things about it if you think about it in terms of tourism, rather than as the art world would prefer to think about it in terms of, say, decolonialism. Because a lot of the tropes through which, you know, the art world has become global don't seem a million miles away from the ways in which the tourist industry became global. And some things are very obvious. You know, for example, when you think of the global expansion of biennials or the global expansion of like white cube spaces, you know, whether museums or Gonzales or whatever, they have that kind of similarity, that familiarity. You know, it's like a resort. Like when you know, something that's very striking about the architecture of resorts is how similar they are. It doesn't matter whether in Corfu, in Mexico, in South Africa, in the Canary Islands, or whatever it is, you know, you've got the swimming pool, you've got the palm trees, everything is white, you know, they've got like tiles, you know, there's that kind of typology of what you expect a resort to have that reproduces itself wherever it is that you find it, and it becomes familiar and safe, and you know that if you're in the resort, you're in good hands, you don't need to worry, it won't be, you know, if there's cockroaches or there's like poo in the toilet, but normally it's like safe and clean and there's people there serving you. So this is a space where you can feel protected from whatever lies outside. I mean, obviously this is also the colonial architecture. You know, this is the city for the colonizers and over there is the city for the colonized, but we don't mix. Okay, so those kind of really kind of border you know, bordered spaces, you know, that kind of sonification that the resort imposes is very clear to see. But if you look at art spaces, they don't function a million miles away from that. You know, you recognize the biennial, you recognize the Museum of Contemporary Art very clearly the minute you walk in. It's white, it's clean, you know, it's got Vetra furniture or some other designer kind of crap, you know, spread around, all very, 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 very tasteful, all kind of Swedish looking. And everybody is white and it's rich and it's safe and, you know, you can feel comfortable wherever it is that you are. So again, you know, like the art world imagines itself to have kind of gone beyond the confines of like Europe and North America because now it's globally distributed, but it's globally distributed in kind of art resorts. Okay, and in a manner that's reminiscent of like travelers in the 60s, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I did a kind of artist residency or whatever, or I went to visit the Biennale in, you know, and now I know what the art scene in all of these other places is, kind of belittling the fact that you were in a very, very specific bubble with people like you who travel to see this safe spaces, you know, in a very organized geography of what remains visible and what doesn't. Okay. And For starters, you know, this like globalization as well only introduces in these light resource spaces what becomes legible to them. And, you know, often the production of people that came to study at Goldsmiths anyway. It's a very kind of crude characterization of this geography, but it works, you know, it's de facto what happens. But the other thing that this kind of globalization of the art world, or this model of globalization, because it's not like I'm calling for some kind of, you know, strong regionalism, you know, local art for local people or anything like that. But it's just that this kind of illusion of something much more globally connected is completely illusory. And partly it's because the kind of channels of communication that they have chosen to replicate are those of the transnational elites. And I think this became very clear to me because several years ago, I was teaching exhibition studies at Central St. Martin's. My title was, you know, I rang an MRes in exhibition studies. But I couldn't afford to go and see shows. And I just kind of thought, I'm not going to be traveling all the time to see whatever, you know, Documenta or Manifesta or whatever any of them wants to do. Because it's just not sustainable for someone like me on a, you know, teacher's salary, you know, with a kid. And it's like, who are these people that can be on a biennial every week or, you know, on this kind of a miserable show in like Frankfurt now and then Cincinnati the next? I mean, like, what kind of subject position does this kind of globalization of the art world that kind of demands that you are kind of keeping up with all this puts you in? And of course, it's the transnational elites. It's the people who have, you know, unrestricted mobility, unrestricted funds, unrestricted time, you know, leisure. And I think we were very guilty of like jumping on that train and being very much seduced by that. And that's a form of tourism. You know, you're kind of pretending to be one of them for a little bit and you feel quite flattered, and, you know, and it can't be joyful. But it's what it is. Right, it's like what we cannot do is like make any claims that made us less Western centric. Not at all. I mean, it's like the game still, like what it is. You know, the kind of processes of exploitation remain kind of, you know, tied to what they are. Even if you have, you know, new players from Russia or China or whatever, you know, like people want to say, like that's a kind of evidence of something less aggressive. So something that has interested me is this, you know, so this moment of the expansion of the museum and the biennial as an illusion of a kind of globally distributed kind of art world that turns out to be just an art world playing the tourist. And I think kind of recently as well, a kind of continuation of that under the guise of decolonization, which is even more problematic. So that museums suddenly decide, oh, yeah, we are a bit colonial. And he's like, but of course, you always were. Welcome to that sudden realization. So we need to sort of decolonize ourselves. And the first kind of knee-jerk reaction a lot of them have is to turn into the British Museum circa 1900 and just go, we're just going to collect things from everywhere. So instead of just buying artists from Catalonia, we're going to buy artists from the whole world. And that's going to be a decolonial gesture, which is a really bizarre way of thinking of how you would decolonize, right? Just by literally replicating the colonial museum in its moment of origin. You know, let's just buy it all up. Weirdly, it's almost as well like kind of money makes you innocent. So it's like, no, but you're not like literally killing anybody anymore to like steal their stuff. Like we give them some money. So because we give them some money, it's okay to just extract all their kind of artifacts and heritage and bring it here. Interestingly as well, you know, when you talk about this, the kind of amounts that are often paid for the most decolonial artifacts in museums are in a different league entirely from the amounts that you would pay if you buy something from Sotheby's, right? And we have seen this, and I cannot give names, but you know, when you want to collect a Guatemalan textile artist who is like magnificent and also incredibly cheap, very good value, and it will revalorize itself. And this, you know, that's something that you also think, you know, it's replicated in the tourist industry. You know, there's like tourist art and proper art. So if somebody does like textiles with a kind of, you know, in a very kind of artisanal way, blah, 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 the idea is that's you know, it's just textiles. They're just doing their thing, the thing they always do. So that's like for tourists. And you pay, you know, you pay for the labor. You know, it might be a little bit more than a kind of Zara textile from Zara Home, but not massively a lot more, right? It's not in the kind of stratospheric kind of price level that a contemporary artwork by somebody in the West plays. And so this is something that's been done without like fully like talking about it, you know, and you know, you talk about reparations, for example, in the art world, but always as something that other museums should do, you know, like ethnographic museums should do that, or like people who collected stuff in the past, but like we are very innocent and look at us, how they colonized that. But they, you know, they engage in this kind of very predatory behavior that we have learned to recognize from tourists. You know, that until quite recently, you could go to Mexico and buy something that had been excavated, you know, and take it away. I mean, you can still do to some degree if you know where to find it, but, you know, it's no longer legal. But, you know, up until 71, you could do that. You could go somewhere, you know, buy their heritage, bring it home. You were still buying it. You weren't necessarily killing anybody to so steal it. But what's the legitimacy of that? And then there's also something else that worries me about this process, which is the way in which very often, you know, those artists that museums in the West most proudly display as the kind of clear symbol of their own decolonization are actually made to perform much in the same way as the kind of, you know, host is made to perform in the hotel lobby. It's like, come here and do some dancing or some singing, but please, you know, wear your traditional uniform, you know, make yourself visible. You know, the clear example that we all sing in films is like the Hawaii dance in the hotel lobby. Like, we're not interested in your singing. We're interested in you coming here and performing as a Hawaii native, even if that performance in itself is only the product of us calling you into this space. And I think museums are being very guilty of this. This is not to say that all indigenous art functions in that register at all, but it is a very you know, harmless, toothless, and depolitical way of welcoming anything that you're going to call indigenous or decolonial into your space. And it's I think, best understood, or at least, I don't know if it's best understood through the lens of tourism, but the lens of tourism makes it really visible. You know, it's almost like you can't unsee it. If you look at these spaces as tourist spaces, as opposed to looking at them strictly as like art spaces, it's like, whoa. Like, what is going on in here? So that's also something I think that it's worth thinking through or with tourism. The issue with this is that, you know, you can, of course, find the kind of value in all of these practices. Okay, so what I need to clarify immediately is not that I'm saying, oh my gosh, you know, you are bringing rituals or weaving or, you know, crafts into the museum. What a terrible decline of museum standards. That's not the problem at all. In fact, you know, the problem is that the museum remains unaffected by those. You know, museums are kind of talking all the time, which is something that I find so bizarre, because, like, you know, you would write that and immediately realize, right, that it cannot be. It's like, we are bringing indigenous cosmologies into the museum, and often all of these cosmologies at the same time. I mean, that is something that I find profoundly offensive, actually. I mean, not that I am personally offended, but the notion that it's like, I'm going to make an exhibition where I bring together all these indigenous cosmologies, like, to coexist. It's like, think of the word cosmology, right? I mean, it's like you can't, like, under what? Under what do they coexist? Under the cosmology of the museum, which remains unaffected. And this is the kind of problem for me, because apart from everything else, you know, for example, if you only think of the case of Latin America, Latin American museology has put forward some of the most, you know, radical, challenging, and like meaningful challenges to sort of museological practice as is that we've seen. You know, it's like I've written about this in the past as well, but, you know, I'm still very kind of captivated by that moment in 72 when Latin American museologists come together in the Santiago de Chile ICOM roundtable. And the first thing they say is, we don't want anybody from Paris coming here telling us what to do. You are not allowed to speak in any other language other than Spanish and Portuguese, of course, no native languages. But nevertheless, you know, it's like, what we're going to talk about is not about museums. We're going to talk about what's outside. We're going to invite agronomists, urban planners, rural teachers. You know, this is what we need to know about. We need to know about the reality of the society around us. And that kind of notion of what they called the integral museum at the time was already a kind of thinking of a museum where this, like, made-up system of the fine arts, those kind of made-up systems of, like, distinct spheres of knowledge that Europe had designed were no longer valid. And this museum was not a museum of preservation and extinction. It was a museum for the production of futures, which I think is also really wonderful. I mean, they really talk about this redirection of the museum towards, you know, not towards the past, but towards the future and the transformation of society. Socially engaged artists in the West have been banging on about this in a completely toothless ways for like three, you know, decades. And then they end up doing a, you know, pedagogy workshop in the kind of corners of the museum as if somebody was going to be like radically transformed by this. But I suppose that my point is, if you're going to think about decolonizing a museum, then you decolonize the museum itself. You know, doing an exhibition where you invite several cosmologies, like Choose Your Peak, and invite people to perform themselves as native under the guise of a museum that remains unchallenged and untransformed, it's like, don't, I mean, that is the most colonial thing you can do. The issue here is that you kind of bring all this stuff in the museum, but the museum itself remains unchallenged. And of course, like Andrew McLellan put it in a recent article, you know, the task here is to decolonize the colony. I mean, the museum itself is a very colonial invention, but undoubtedly so, you know, not just for all of the reasons that we've spoken about of how it projects, you know, particular versions of progress and extinction on different people, but because, you know, its mode of accumulation, its mode of, you know, symbolic violence was always kind of geared towards what it was, even when it appeared elsewhere, right? So, you know, part of the role that museums perform in places other than the West was to perform the kind of inferiority of local cultures in relation to what was in the museum. When we were talking about Latin America before, you know, just the simple division between what is prehistory and history becomes very visible in the museum. And that's, of course, not politically neutral. So, I mean, we can sort of try to sort of beef up that argument for hours, but I think it's uncontroversial to say that the museum is a colonial invention, that the task of decolonizing the museum cannot just be these like minor arrangements and much less, you know, minor interventions like one exhibition. I don't know how to put it. I mean, one never knows whether this is an issue of bad faith or simple inability or unwillingness to sort of do the thing. But you do sort of wonder, you know, why the kind of desire to sort of play, you know, the innocent institution, to call yourself, you know, decolonized or working towards decolonization, instead of really grappling with that history, which I think is something that we should do. I know that this is not necessarily how it feels, but how I always start teaching a module that I teach on museums, galleries, and exhibitions at Goldsmiths is by saying the museum is probably not going to survive. So it's kind of up to you to think of what we have instead. You know, the museum is such a residual institution. You know, it's part of a project that's no longer really dominant or hegemonic. So I do think it is part of something that is lasting, but on its way out. And you can just simply give up on these institutions, or you can try to reimagine them for something that might feel more necessary to what we ought to do. Certainly sort of propping up the careers of like globally successful artists and propping up the collections and the market value of global collectors is not the kind of socially satisfying role that museums claim themselves to have. But increasingly that's what they're going towards, you know, as public funding withdraws and, you know, private donors, you know, start taking more and more of a sort of prominent role, not just at the level of funding, but also of decision making. At the risk of being bombastic, museums are becoming the enemy of the people. And there was always a project that was, even if it was fake, it was legitimized on the basis of an emancipatory narration, right? So like, even if that emancipation was based on, you know, some kind of bogus idea of human autonomy as per, you know, Kant, etc., the idea was the museum was working towards, you know, collective emancipation. And this is still in the kind of mission statements of museums. You know, when you read those kind of documents out there, you know, what is a museum for? Or, you know, museums promote contact with art and culture, you know, raising pertinent questions about contemporary society. And, you know, it's always some kind of bombastic notion that tells you that the more you engage with a museum, the more sort of like critical and informed your relationship with the society that surrounds you will be. And thereby, you know, the better and informed the society at large will be, and the better and informed the kind of modes of governance will become, you know. So it is, you know, however, laterally, it was always tied to these processes of emancipation. So it's not anecdotal or insignificant that they are increasingly dominated by those who would have nothing to gain by those processes. So at that level, you know, that you start bombastically announcing that you are decolonizing while leaving the infrastructure intact and merely allowing some space for representation in the exhibition space, and a representation that's already kind of ordained or kind of organized on the basis of, you know, the exoticization of some people and the kind of normalization of others. But moreover as well, and this is going into rant territory, but the other thing that I find profoundly problematic is this way in which we are going to indigenous cultures and it's like, save us. You know, come here with your wisdom and sort it all out for us. Which again, you know, when you think of this through the logic of tourism, is that same logic of the world is ending, I'm going to the village. I'm moving, you know, I'm retreating to the forest because the world is ending. So it's like the world is ending, like the wisdom of indigenous people are now. It's like, of course, if the wisdom of indigenous people could have, you know, if we had, you know, cared a little bit more about, you know, nature and our own kind of interdependence and all of these things, we would be elsewhere. But that's on you now to sort it out. You know, I mean, this notion that you create this representative space where you come in and you sort of somehow gives us the solutions to sort it all out, it's, again, profoundly problematic, especially as nothing, no sacrifice is involved, if that makes sense. You know, so it's like nobody needs to sacrifice anything in order for that to enter the space of, you know, the exhibitionary, for example. As we were saying, you know, you have a kind of global expansion of like art spaces, a global expansion of like biennials, triennials, you know, documentas, whatever, which is really rapid and really dense. I mean, you have some territories like Africa where the map is slightly less dense, but pretty much worldwide, you have this like rapid expansion of this network of like safe spaces for art people. And they operate not just as kind of independent spaces, but you also have these franchises, you know, like the Guggenheim, like the Louvre, you know, suddenly operating a little bit like the Méliès, you know. And of course, the relationship here is more than simply analogical, it's direct, you know. So when Manifesta comes to Barcelona, Manifesta goes anywhere, where any biennial is proposed anywhere, you know, there's something that they tell artists. It's like, oh, this is about, you know, highlighting the Catalonian art scene or whatever. You know, some curatorial narrative will be put on the table, but the kind of back conversation that is had with local authorities is always about tourism, right? So it's always about, you know, if we do this biennial, you know, more tourists will come. If we open this museum, you know, it'll draw a better quality of tourists. You know, this is also kind of interesting, you know, so it's like the cultural tourists, which is not the sea and sand. This is a kind of slightly more, you know, sophisticated slash rich tourist that's going to come to see the biennial or the museum. I mean, it's already kind of significant that a place like Barcelona, which is, you know, being crushed under the weight of tourism, says, what do we need? A manifesto. Like, why, right? And then the logic seems to be, it's like, no, but we're going to send them to L'Hospitalet or, you know, any of those kind of peripheral areas where the local people are now going to live because they can't afford to live in Barcelona. Now that's where they're going to take the kind of cultural tourist of manifest. They're going to go there. I mean, but it's always that, you know, I'm speaking of Barcelona because we're here, but it is always that, you know, the sort of the expansion of this network always comes, you know, wrapped up in some promise of what cultural tourism is going to come on the back of that. But something I wanted to mention is that potentially the best achievement of my life, something I'm very proud of, was impeding a franchise that the city council in Santa Cruz de Tenerife, where I'm from, wanted to put forward. So that was 60 million euros for a Rodin museum in the Canary Islands. So it's not obviously not my individual achievement, but like being part of this like big campaign to sort of stop it from happening. And, you know, I think those moments are interesting because they do sort of offer the what instead of that. You know, so the idea was, like, we're going to spend 60 million in rehabilitating this space in the middle of the city and bringing lots of like Rodin sculptures here because the tourists would like it, apparently, you know, because the relationship with Rodin and Tenerife is so obvious. So then you campaign to say, don't do that. You know, that's a crazy amount of money to spend on something that nobody wants, nobody needs, et cetera, et cetera. But the kind of flip side of that is the sort of conversations that happen when you say, okay, so what could it be if it wasn't this? You know, what sort of an institution, you know, given that there is this space, that it's in the middle of the city, that the city council has said it's kind of up for grabs, what would we want? And I think those are the conversations that we need around museums. You know, these are massive public infrastructures, often in the middle of cities, often occupying a lot of space at a time when, you know, these spaces are very scarce. And in Barcelona, you still have a kind of very healthy network of like social centers, you know, neighborhood spaces, et cetera, et cetera. Somewhere like London, there's literally nothing that you can occupy. You know, they've closed down our libraries. You know, we don't even have a local library anymore. So either you pay to be somewhere, or you, you know somebody in a university that can leave you, you know, a classroom for an afternoon, or you have massive, big museums. But they're, as a rule, not open to different uses than those that have been, you know, designed by curators. So those are the, you know, those are the decolonizing gestures that I would like to see. You know, it's like, what? Why are we dragging this institution, you know, from the 1800s? You know, forcefully in the 2024s, you know, or in the 2020s, when it clearly, you know, cannot be legitimized on the basis on which it was founded. You know, like what kind of collective conversations do we need to sort of rethink what the purpose of these institutions are? And then that, you know, that would allow for an occupation of those spaces that doesn't feel so sanitized, depoliticized, and fake, maybe is the word, given that we're talking about tourism. You know. Whenever you mention the kind of pitfalls of tourism, you know, you will get these questions which are like, how can we do it better? How can I cause less damage? You know, shall I buy, you know, offset my air miles, or, you know, just travel by train, you know, just all of this kind of, you know, yeah, how to be a little bit less shitty sort of like rhetoric. And it happens in the most like bizarre ways. Like, I mean, some of my colleagues who are academics, you know, the question is about academic conferences. You know, so the things that you would think are really, really easy to give up. I mean, perhaps other people like academic conferences more than I do, but it's like, I would much rather stay home and connect on Zoom or whatever it is than travel to some random space and be surrounded by academics. And yet, you know, it's like, how could we do academic conferences better, you know? And what that reveals is this incapacity to sort of think, yes, of letting go, of sacrifices, of like, no, I know you're attached to them and you like them and they might be the sort of epitome of your social life, but you just need to let them go. I mean, there's kind of no justification, right? I mean, not just for academic conferences, but for, you know, art travel. And I say that as somebody who's sitting here living in London, right? So it's not, I'm certainly not this kind of innocent party, but you know, it's absurd that we continue to sort of engage in those trips. And then there's the issue of tourism, which kind of belongs to a different order because it's not work. It's my moment of like being myself. And if you take away my 2 weeks in the sun, all I have is my work life. And those are the moments when I'm kind of being myself. So, yeah, I mean, the issue is, A, with a kind of lack of awareness of how unevenly distributed that privilege is, you know, like despite the United Nations Tourism Organization saying it's a human right, is far from being something that most people indulge in. But also the fact that it's kind of not really about you making that choice or you making the other choice, you know, that these are, you know, structural, global industries, you know, these are, the solutions are not going to go via your own making of ethical choices. You know, the solutions are going to come through the sort of political demand for different policies, different modes of taxation, different modes of redistribution. I mean, some people, it's quite, you know, there is like a whole spectrum of how people imagine we should let go of this model of tourism. So, for example, you know, one of them would say, okay, this cannot be mass tourism anymore. So we need to go back to something like the Grand Ole Tour. You just charge people through their ears to go anywhere so that they, you know, like you get a tenth or a hundredth of the people who travel today, but they leave the same amount of money wherever it is they go, because it's only elite tourism. You know, it's like the upper classes that now travel and they leave so much money wherever they go that you don't need to cater for like millions of tourists. You only cater for like 10,000 tourists and you make the same amount of money. This might make sense if you think of places like Tenerife, where, you know, the kind of profit margin is very, very small and it's based on volume. You know, so if you have millions of people going there, you know, for like spending a week on like 400 euros or something, then you need loads of numbers to sort of make a profit. So shrink the numbers, up the profit, more sustainable, you know, better for everyone. But redistribution is not talked about. So it's not like you're going to have all these like millionaires traveling and then suddenly the waiters are getting paid better money or the people who clean your room. It's like same kind of misery wages, less kind of travel, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I honestly think that the solutions are not going to come from policy alone, but from the sort of trying out of different modes of diverting our kind of attachment to those 2 weeks in the sun. You know, like, are there ways in which we can have those 2 weeks in the sun, 52 weeks a year, in ways that are much more embroiled in our everyday lives? And of course, what I'm going to say now is a bit of a boutade, but, you know, being who I am and having the history that I have and working where I work, I'd like to think that perhaps that's one role that these kind of reimagined cultural institution could fulfill. You know, that those kinds of attachments, those things that are not part of our everyday life, you know, are not... you know, those expectations are not going to be met by walking around a white cube looking at paintings, but museums might sort of, or art institutions at large, might work towards, you know, this provision of spaces where something like the imagination of something that's not already in existence could collectively take place. It's not historically unprecedented. It's not like we don't have models of how that might work. But it never works just with the kind of people that currently go to museums, people who are better off if nothing changes, shorthand. The kind of programs that we organize in museums, the kind of hierarchies that museums regulate themselves by, you know. But maybe that's, you know, that's one way again in which we can think the embroilment between these two places, you know, like holidays, you know, the kind of romance of the holiday is fiction making, right? So we're not a million miles away from that task, interfering there.